I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. What's the deal with the $700 billion bailout? Well, that's pretty much the question that Republicans and Democrats asked Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson and Fed Chair Ben Bernanke this morning. Republicans wondering, where's the money going? Democrats, like Maxine Waters, asking, why isn't it going to people in foreclosure? She herself has been trying to renegotiate bad mortgages.
I stay on the line for 1 hour just trying to get to a servicer. They are understaffed. They don't take this seriously. And then when you talk with the services, they don't even know enough to be able to evaluate the income of those persons who are trying to get some help.
Meanwhile, auto industry leaders will walk the congressional plank this afternoon, testifying before the Senate Banking Committee. Later in the program, an economist responds to General Motors' plea that if they don't get a bailout, millions of jobs will be lost. But first, jobs. The drumbeat of layoffs continues. Today, the city of Chicago announced it's laying off nearly 800 workers and will eliminate more than 1,000 jobs that are now vacant. Yesterday, Citigroup, the financial services giant that runs Citibank, announced plans to cut an additional 53,000 employees over the next year from its global workforce. So, is there any good news here? Well, maybe a little. Heidi Scherholz is an economist with the Economic Policy Institute in Washington, D.C., where she researches trends in employment and compensation. She says there are some jobs, but Heidi, we understand that there is one sector in particular that is adding jobs, but you have to be comfortable in a headlamp?
That's right. That's exactly right. So mining is one sector that is continuing to add jobs. It's bucking every negative trend that we're seeing now in the labor market. The issue is, however, that mining makes up only about 0.5% of the employment in this country. So not everyone is going to be able to find a job in mining, but it is still going strong.
But what are more relevant, let's put it that way, at least to more people, sectors?
So there's two sectors that are continuing to grow. So healthcare, it's not a generally cyclical sector. Demand for health services just doesn't follow the business cycle. So health services are just chugging along.
And we know, too, that, baby boomers are growing older, so we understand that different sectors of healthcare are especially increasing, including nursing.
That's exactly right. Nursing care facilities are continuing to add jobs. Now, the aging of the population doesn't really play into these trends that are happening in this short-term downturn that we're facing right now. But you're exactly right. As we see the population shifting, what health services people pick up is also reflecting that.
Okay, well, we know, too, that government has traditionally been a stable employer. And you write that government employment actually grew last month, adding 23,000 jobs.
Mm-hmm.
But is that continuing?
So it's starting to flatten out. We've seen government continue to add jobs over this whole year as the rest of the economy has shed jobs. One strong engine of that growth up until August had been state government employment. But now state governments are starting to really feel the fiscal squeeze, especially related to declining property values and decreasing revenues. But local governments are continuing to add jobs. So the overall government sector is still a positive spot.
Do you think that will continue? Because we know how much cities depend on bonds, for instance, and bond sales, and that's so tied to Wall Street.
That's exactly right. So it's interesting. If you look at the trend over time, local government employment, the growth does not yet appear to be slowing down, but one of their major sources of revenue is, we all know, going to start drying up. So we don't expect that to continue going like the gangbusters it has been.
Okay. Well, now, where are the biggest losses? We've been talking about some glimmers of hope for where jobs might be, but where are the biggest cuts?
So the biggest cuts are exactly where you'd expect them to be. We see them in manufacturing. Manufacturing has been on a long decline, but in the last 10 months, it's just the bottom has fallen out, especially in durable goods manufacturing. You think of, people just put off buying that car or that expensive piece of electronic.
I'm looking at some of your stats. You say job losses occurred in most industries. 60% of industries shed jobs, but factory jobs down by 90,000 last month, and that includes the decline in autos and parts.
That's exactly right. So one caveat of that decline right there also included a strike at Boeing. But even if you account for that strike, it was still a dramatic decline. The other sector where we're still seeing huge drops, it always happens that construction gets hit during a recession. But with the particular character of this downturn, construction is just getting slammed.
And Heidi, before we let you go, we want to make sure we've pointed out, we talk about unemployment numbers. The numbers have now reached a 14-year high of 6.5%. Some experts say unemployment may reach 8%. It's certainly not, you know, depression era numbers of 30%, but it also doesn't include a group of the unemployed that are sort of underemployed workers. Tell us about that.
That's exactly right. So the unemployment rate of 6.5% really masks just how difficult it is for many people to find a job in this economy. And there's two groups of workers that it leaves out, as you said. So it's the so-called marginally attached workers, who are people who they report wanting a job, but they're just not actively seeking for whatever reason. They've given up actively seeking a job, so they're not officially counted as unemployed. And another important group is those who we refer to as involuntarily part-time workers. These are people who want a full-time job, are available for full-time work, and they just can't get the hours.
Because people may not be laying off, but they may be cutting back on hours.
Cutting
and overtime
back on the hours dimension. And many families really depend on those. You know, in good times, they depend on the overtime hours. And in not so good times, they at the very least depend on getting up to those, you know, 35, 40 hours a week. So this really puts a squeeze on families who maybe they are keeping their jobs, but they're just seeing their wages stagnate and just not being able to get the hours that they want. The number of part-time workers now is actually the highest it's been since we have started measuring involuntary part-time workers in the way that we do today.
Heidi Scherholz, economist with the Economic Policy Institute in Washington, D.C. If you have skills as a miner, you may be in luck, but otherwise it's a pretty bleak landscape. Heidi, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Well, what about the high-tech sector? Champagne was recently flowing there, but now layoffs are underway at Cisco, Intel, Google. Sun Microsystems is laying off 6,000 workers. Paul Blumenfeld is with High Tech Ventures in Cambridge, Massachusetts. He's a job recruiter, placing applicants from entry-level to CEOs at high-tech startups. And Paul, are you feeling the recent headlines in what you do?
We definitely are. We're definitely seeing a decline. It's a good time to be building something. As a startup, if you're not looking for customers and you don't need to sell anything yet, you've recently got funding, you're not planning for this, so it doesn't matter.
Right.
So it's a good time to hire engineers still for those kind of companies. So maybe while the amount of companies looking to hire has gone down by about 25%, the amount of people who are calling me looking for jobs has probably gone up by more than 100%.
Yeah, because it's the companies who do depend upon consumers that are having trouble. We understand Circuit City filed for bankruptcy protection. Best Buy says it's having the worst conditions in 42 years. So people aren't selling things as much. Is that what you're seeing?
Correct, yes. Yeah. So we're seeing a lot of companies that, from a timing perspective, if you look at their business plans where they were planning on starting to sell something by now and starting to have revenue fund their operations, those companies are starting to have trouble and they're figuring out ways to either extend the runway, lay off people, or close their doors.
Right.
And we're seeing a lot of both.
What happened here? Because Eric Schmidt, of course, the famous creator and head of Google, said about 2 months ago that he thought that all the economic drama was on Wall Street and not out here, meaning out where he is in Silicon Valley. So, you know, is it just that people stop buying? I mean, what else is hitting the industry?
I think the last 2 months took everybody by storm, and I think it's partially fear. There was a memo written, and I can't come up with the name, by a VC that sent a wave of fear through all the VC-funded startup land, and every employer...
Venture capitalist, yeah, just to remind people.
Yes,
yeah.
And every employer sort of shared it with their employees, and their VCs each all shared it with their portfolio companies. And it basically said, all of us get into bunker mode, hunker down, and figure out how to extend the runway. And they're all just figuring out how to conserve cash.
Well, one analyst said it felt like a light switch turning off, the way people just stopped buying computers and iPhones. So what does that do for somebody looking for a job? You've said that there are still the jobs with the people who are doing startups and things like that. But boy, employers can afford to be much more choosy now. They have more to choose from.
That is correct. And I'd say one of the most important things to think about when you're looking for a job, if you can act before you've been laid off, you're going to be looking from much more of a position of strength than if you wait until you're laid off. If a company has a layoff, then presumably there's going to be several people or several dozen people who look just like you who are hitting the market at the exact same time.
And we're understanding that companies might lay off people now in this market, not because financially they have to lay off people, but because why? They see maybe better candidates coming on the market?
Well, I don't think any company would ever admit to it, but there's certainly evidence that people see better candidates out there. There are some really diamonds out there, and people want to get them.
And can they also maybe get these diamonds who've now been laid off from other troubled companies, get these diamonds for a little less than they would have had to pay at another time?
You know, that really depends on the company and the candidate. Some candidates really draw a line in the sand and won't do it. And if the candidate is super strong, they're going to get their money. But oftentimes, I would say the salaries have gone down. And they are also valuing the option, the stock option part of the compensation. Ironically, now they are valuing it a lot more because you get so many more shares.
Even if Wall Street is hurting and we're watching, you know, stock portfolios plummet, they're still looking to get stock options as part of their pay.
Absolutely. I still ask people all the time when we go into the offer negotiation phase of an interview process, if there's a chance to trade cash salary for options or the other way around, which would you prefer? 85% or better say, I'd rather have more stock.
Faith in the future markets.
Exactly.
And you say you find more people jobs by helping them extend their networks to places they wouldn't have considered. Give us an example.
People need to understand that you really possess two sets of skills. You have your objective skills, which is what you know, and your subjective skills, which is who you know. And at the end of the day, you want to always be figuring out who are the best people I've ever worked with. And that's what I encourage people to do when they call me, because most of the people who call me are not people that I can help. So I try to tell them to explore their network. Think of all of the best people that they've ever worked for. And where are they now, and have they contacted them yet?
Well, some analysts are comparing what's happening now in the high-tech industry to the dot-com bubble burst. You know, given that, I mean, what do you tell people who are coming to you? I mean, are you telling them to broaden outside of the industry? I mean, what do you tell them?
As far as recommending people go outside their current skill set, I mean, yeah, if you want to restart your career, I don't find the companies that I work with really value training as a skill. If somebody says, well, I took a class in Java, most of my clients are not looking to hire somebody who's acquired that skill through classroom education.
So to take some courses now in the high-tech industry on some other kind of software, for instance, may not be the best idea.
It might not be the best idea. I'd still focus on finding the job. That your time will be better spent on looking into the job.
That you already have skills for.
Right, that you already have skills for.
Paul Blumenfeld of the Cambridge, Massachusetts company, High Tech Ventures. By the way, Paul, how has this hit the industry that really, you know, I'm guessing, felt itself a little immune? I mean, we heard about all the Google perks and, you know, if you were in high tech, you were pretty much cruising. How has this hit people in the industry?
I think the best people, I placed somebody this week who had 5 or 6 job offers. The very best people, you know, the top 2% of the market will get many, many offers. But some of these people, depending on what their skill sets are and depending on where they've worked in the past and what their network is, are going to be on the market for a long time.
Bad news. Paul, thank you so much again. Paul Blumenfeld, a headhunter. What about jobs at GM? That's next. Should the government jump in to try to save those jobs? Also later today, are you in the cult of clean and flu season? Back in a minute, here and now. Welcome back. What's good for General Motors is what? That's the question Congress takes up this afternoon. Should the federal government bail out GM and other car makers? GM stock has been trading at values last seen in 1946, and GM is begging for money. Detroit overall is running out of gas, and some supporters of a bailout say it could be seen as a jobs program that would resuscitate the whole economy, remake the Rust Belt. Others say, let GM fail. A reorganization is long overdue. Peter Morici is professor of business at the Maryland School of Business, an economist in the Clinton administration, and he's testifying before Congress on this issue today. So, Peter, what will you say? Where do you stand?
Well, essentially, I think we ought to let them go through reorganization. General Motors looked at what happened with AIG. They said, if we fail, financial markets fail. And so you have to bail us out, and we did. This is a very different situation. This is an ongoing manufacturing operation. The country needs the cars that General Motors makes. There may be an excess supply of automobile capacity, but not 22%, which is about General Motors' market share. the company is worth more operating than it is closed.
Oh, so you're saying, let me be clear, because you're not saying let them fail and go away. You're saying what? When you say reorganization, what do you mean by that?
Go into Chapter 11 and get debtor in possession financing, like the airlines did. They kept on flying, and the steel companies did. They kept on making steel.
Well, now, some people say with cars it's different because people might buy a ticket, get on a plane, and get off the other end. They don't have any other investment. But when you buy a car, you worry that the warranty might not be there. So people won't buy cars if they feel GM is in bankruptcy.
There's two issues. One is, can they get financing? And I maintain that they can because they owe banks a great deal of money. And the company is worth more to the banks if it's operating than if they have to sell it off in pieces. The second thing is, once customers see it operating, they'll recognize that it's going to continue operating. It's just a matter of who will own it. If you go to Circuit City today, which is in Chapter 11 reorganization, and you buy a television set and you get one of their store warranties, that warranty is not backed up by Circuit City, but rather a third party. It is possible to deal with this problem. General Motors is dismissing them all, and I can understand why. Rick Wagner owns a lot of shares in General Motors, and the shareholders would be wiped out. This is about Rick Wagner saving his hide.
Let's talk about Rick Wagner, the head of General Motors, who's been taking out full-page ads saying, you know, millions of jobs are going to be lost because of other industries that are dependent on GM. Do you think that part of any deal that is made, you know, a government-run bankruptcy perhaps, do you think that part of any deal should be that management is changed?
No, I don't. I don't think the Congress is in a position to pick managers. We've already seen how well the federal government operates AIG. My feeling is it's better to just let them go through Chapter 11 and let bankruptcy court deal with changes in management. I know I wouldn't want to give them $25 billion of federal money and yank Rick Wagner tomorrow. I think that would create chaos.
Well, now, let's be clear then. You're saying that you think that GM and perhaps other companies should be allowed to go into bankruptcy. You're not saying, I want to be very clear, that they should get any bailout money, which they're asking for. They're asking for short-term loans to get through what they're calling a bad patch.
We don't know what they need because they haven't gone through the process of soliciting debtor-in-possession financing, which bankrupt companies normally do. Remember, Chapter 11 has the purpose of reorganizing the company's debt, not closing the company, which is Chapter 7. That is not going to happen. They provide about 50% of the vehicles sold in the United States. We could not get along without those factories. Those factories have real value. They're not going away. The question is, how do we manage this process?
Well, so you're saying no money from the government until GM and other companies go into bankruptcy so that there can be transparency and everybody can see where they are.
Exactly. There's no transparency right now. This is a French farce.
French farce. Well, and we've seen executives from GM on 60 Minutes talking about the helicopters they have and the jets they have and how they trash the idea of electric cars that they thought, you know, up until last month that Americans wanted more SUVs. You say don't off with their heads yet.
What I'm saying is the Congress shouldn't be offing with their heads. Let the bankruptcy process sort this out. Mm-hmm. It is good at that. The creditors will have a lot to say about who stays and who goes.
Do you worry at all that if GM is allowed to go into bankruptcy, that it will fail and that foreign companies will come in and buy those factories, foreign companies that don't have the health benefits for their employees that American companies worry about, that don't have the older, aging workforce that American companies have, that have it a little bit easier? Do you worry that, you know, foreign companies will come in and take away the car industry?
Well, no, I'm not particularly worried about that. Let me explain why. First of all, the Japanese manufacturers operating here do provide health benefits. They do pay good wages. And if they took over these factories, the workers would be more secure. The second thing is, we're going to go through this one way or another. If the federal government gives these guys $25 billion, they'll go through that in about a year at their present rate.
In other words, it's just a stopgap and it'll just disappear.
And we'll end up going through this again, and then the problem will be even worse and there'll be even more jobs lost.
We understood that in Japan, for instance, the government takes care of the health care of car workers. And it's one thing that the car industry in the U.S. has been crying about, that they have to absorb all these benefits that foreign companies don't.
Well, if we had national health insurance, we'd have a tax for it. And General Motors would have to pay that tax like any other company. The Japanese manufacturers here would have to pay that tax, and it would probably be about equal to what they're paying for health care benefits. Mm-hmm. You see, General Motors wants you to believe that someone else created its problems. When they were manufactured in Detroit, it was a joint product of both the labor unions and the managers. They've created a morass.
There's talk of creating an auto industry czar to, you know, sort of force the car companies into serious restructuring. Is that possible with the closeness between the now in power Democrats and the auto industry?
I think it's a terrible idea. If we get an auto industry czar, he's going to be very favorably disposed towards the unions because of who's about to take office. That is the last thing that we need, just like we don't need someone favorably disposed towards management. We don't want the process of working out the automobile industry, the Detroit Three, to be politicized. That's why it's better over in the judiciary branch, in bankruptcy court, which is where Chapter 11 would be worked out, than it is in the halls of Congress or the executive branch.
But should the auto industry be forced to be more green, or do you think that, I mean, you know, again, I was speaking of John Lutz, he didn't believe in global warming. Do you think the market's going to force them to rethink?
We will force them to be more green through our environmental policies, quite separate from this workout.
Peter Morici, professor of business at the Maryland School of Business, former chief economist at the U.S. International Trade Commission under the Clinton administration, and he is about to speak to Congress about the car industry today. So, Peter, we thank you so much for your time.
It's been a pleasure. Bye-bye.
Well, tomorrow, as Barack Obama lines up his financial gurus, we'll learn about the conservative Republican Mormon from Utah behind Democrat FDR's New Deal. That's tomorrow. Still ahead, the culture of clean after the news here and now. A new study finds that women have more types of germs on their hands than men. Turns out little boys were right. We've got cooties. Actually, it might be because of the acidity on women's skin. The University of Colorado examined the hands of dozens of undergrad students, male and female, and found each hand was home to about 150 different kinds of bacteria. Now, if that makes you want to run to the hand sanitizer, wait. Did you know that if you were germ-free, you'd be dead in 2 weeks? Carlin Flora is senior editor of Psychology Today, and she's written about what she's calling the cult of clean, a country obsessed with eliminating germs. And Carlin, let's start with those hand sanitizers. A decade ago, they were only available at hospitals. Now people carry them in their purses. In our building, we have a dispenser on a stand by the door, and people love it. They say it prevents colds. So what do you think the problem is? What's the problem with that?
The problem is, if we use these kinds of sanitizers or cleaning products, some people do believe that they could spawn these superbugs. The germs sort of have an ability to come back stronger, bigger, badder when we try to eliminate them. And then the other thing is the psychological aspect, that we somehow have this idea now that we can eliminate germs and that that is a good thing.
Well, tell us more about that. How many germs are on us and why do we need them?
The adult human body, for example, has about 100 trillion cells, and only 10% of those actually belong to us, are actually cells of our body. The rest are germs. And a lot of them are very helpful. They live in the digestive tract and help you break down food and secure nutrients that you need. So we have a very irrational fear of germs and dirt. And yes, some germs do cause disease, and we have a very good idea of how to avoid most of those diseases. But we seem now to be sort of emboldened by these new cleaning products into thinking that we can eliminate all germs.
Well, and, you know, so we've got office supply stores, as you write, that sell germ-resistant highlighters and scissors. I mean, you go deeper and find why we're doing this. I mean, we know, for instance, that cleanliness is next to godliness. You know, it's something that maybe religions teach. But you spoke to religious experts and found out that there was another theory there.
Yeah, there's a really interesting theory about social fears that John Portman from the University of Virginia brought up to me, which is that, you know, think about the 60s. There was actually a lot of irrational beliefs about swimming pools at that time, that, were swimming pools being chlorinated enough? And really that fear was based on the fact that these pools were recently integrated and that African Americans were using the pools. So it could be that now that we're a much more diverse society, we're traveling more, we're mingling more, that some of the fears we may have about mingling with unknown groups might manifest itself in our wanting to sort of clean ourselves more or sanitize our environments.
Those are fascinating theories. I'm just going to jump in to say that there were rational fears of swimming pools in the 50s because illnesses like polio were spread through swimming pools.
Right, sure. So there are always many factors involved, and some of the health concerns are legitimate, but some of them could also look like health concerns but really be more of a social anxiety.
Well, you also quote the late anthropologist Mary Douglas, who wrote the book Purity and Danger, who said that an occupation with dirt, even though it runs through religions, and, you know, we're saying cleanliness and godliness, it's not about hygiene. What did she feel it was about?
It was really about keeping chaos at bay. So it was really about organization and order. And this makes sense to a lot of people on a gut level. When you feel that things are out of control in your life, a lot of us feel that straightening up our houses is a way to sort of regain a little bit of control and feel better about a stressful situation.
It can really slip over into a sort of a disorder almost.
Right. You can sort of see this on a spectrum, and on the extreme end would be those with OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder. And cleaning is actually sort of a go-to activity for anxious people because it's easy to do. And they clean because they think if they don't, something bad will happen. And the interesting thing is that the more they clean, the more anxious they get, because the real way to fight through that anxiety is to avoid cleaning. And then they'll see that nothing bad actually happens.
You quote some fascinating research pointing out that our idea that we need to just disinfect ourselves parallels a rise of anxiety in our culture. There's a psychologist at the San Diego State University who did a study and compared today's average teenager with a psychiatric patient of 50 years ago. What did he find?
So the levels of anxiety in today's average teenager are equivalent to those in patients treated for a psychiatric disorder 50 years ago. So it makes sense that anxiety would show up in a lot of different areas of life, cleaning being one of them.
Well, you also say that this kind of strain of trying to achieve cleanliness affects women more than men.
Right. The reason it would affect women more than men is because, you know, marketers are very good at playing upon our fears and anxieties. So they've definitely sort of made women feel that if their houses aren't sparkling clean, that they may be exposing their children to bugs or illnesses. And the reality is that women still do the brunt of housework, even if they're working. So the person in the house who does the most housework is going to be disproportionately affected by this trend of higher cleaning standards.
Well, and the irony is that while some women are just desperate to try to, you know, make things perfect for their children, we do hear the isolated story, you know, of someone who has a bacteria that becomes flesh-eating. You know, you hear these stories.
You do hear the stories, but you bring up a really good point, which is risk misperception. You know, one psychologist pointed out to me there's a much, much higher chance of dying from an obesity-related disease than from salmonella. But you run screaming when you hear about salmonella. Mm-hmm. No one runs screaming from a Big Mac, is what he said.
Well, and you've also met scientists that believe that homes that are too sanitized are actually fostering allergic disorders in children.
Exactly. The way the immune system works is it strengthens in relation to challenges. So children who grow up in sanitized environments, who never get to run around in the dirt, aren't going to be exposed to things that would actually build up their immune system and help them fight real diseases. And a lot of scientists believe that that is one of the reasons we've seen such an explosion in allergies and asthma.
But, you know, where do you draw the line? Because we're also thinking this may be true in America, but then we hear of third world countries where children are dying because they don't have simple sanitized situations. They are dying of diarrhea and other bugs that they're picking up.
Of course, we need general good hygiene, clean water. The biggest thing that we need to do is simply wash our hands really well after using the restroom, and that protects us from almost all the bugs that we're exposed to. And a lot of people aren't getting that basic message, but yet at the same time, they're sort of worried on the other extreme about things they shouldn't be worried about.
Well, speaking of extremes, you quote writer Catherine Aschenberg. Her book is The Dirt on Clean and Unsanitized History, and she tells people that we really don't need to wash above the wrists very often.
Right. I mean, she was saying this in a slightly facetious way to highlight sort of how out of whack we are. But people, even when she said it in that casual kind of joking way, were very much revolted by that. And it just shows that the cultural standard is very high for cleanliness.
That's Carlin Flora, senior editor of Psychology Today. And we'll link you to her article, The Cult of Clean, How We've Become a Nation of Grime Fighters. And there's growing evidence that we're sacrificing our safety and our sanity to sanitation. Carlin, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
And don't forget, in about 5 minutes, WALL-E, the film that some say could be the first kids film to win the Academy Award for Best Picture. You're listening to Here and Now. It seemed like a good idea at the time, but political activist Sonny Scroggins of Topeka, Kansas, had no idea what he was in for when he proposed a national holiday in honor of the election of the first African-American president, Barack Obama. Scroggins has been honored himself after he lobbied Kansas to recognize Martin Luther King Day, but his suggestion of a new Obama Day didn't go over very well. The Topeka Capital Journal first wrote a blurb about it, but that created so much web traffic it almost shut down the paper's website. Sonny Scroggins joins us on the line from Topeka. And Sonny, oh, we're seeing, 36 pages of reader comments, and some are really critical. Did you expect this kind of reaction?
No, I really thought everybody would embrace it, but it's people want to look good but not be good.
Well, some of the comments are very nasty. Some have compared Obama to Hitler. Some are racist. They've called white people who voted for Obama traitors to their race. But some are, people are saying, well, wait a second, isn't it too soon? Doesn't he need to prove himself? Do you understand that?
Well, yes, certainly I do. But this was what he's already done. November the 4th, 2008 will go down in history, and it's more of a holiday for we the people.
So you think that because this is a moment in history, regardless of the man, and because of the man, as you said, because he accomplished this moment in history, that in and of itself should be noted?
Yes, very much so. It's the date in which America grew up. We can ill afford to hold this racism, toting kind of thing. How one of them said, we traded America. No, America is a diverse society, and that's what makes America great.
Well, let me ask you something else, though, another way of looking at that, Sonny. Isn't it possible that the election of Barack Obama is shining a light, is letting us see, is giving us more transparency to let us see the pockets of racism that still remain and that they're a lot less than there were?
Well, thank you, Robin. I think you're absolutely right. There is pockets of racism, but people are just wanting to hold on to the old ways. And, Barack Obama's not only black, but he's white as well.
He's mixed race.
He represents the best of both races, and I think it's about time. And when I think about the slaves en route over here, not the ones that made it, but the ones en route over here, losing their lives, everybody said, well, when? Well, we're talking about 500 years. If not now, when? I think we need to give ourselves a gift. That's what I was looking for. And I think it should be Election Day. I think every first Tuesday in November of the year, people should celebrate.
What about a day that celebrates elections, American elections, as opposed to Barack Obama? Because I think that's what the problem that people have with it, that, the days that we have for presidents come after, after they've served for a while. What about a day that just celebrated election?
Well, that was the whole intent, Robin, and you are still have problems with that as well. Racism is, I don't know, they wear it like it's a badge. I'm serious.
Well, organizations haven't officially gotten behind your idea, but one, we're reading, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, the NAACP, has said that, it sounds like a good idea, the idea of noting the day of tremendous significance for a community that was once enslaved. But how do you plan to proceed from here? Because there has been so much criticism. Are you going to continue with your idea of having, planning sessions and really trying to push this forward?
Yes, we're meeting at the Topeka Shawnee County Public Library every Saturday from 9 until 10:30 in the morning.
And are people coming?
Yes, they are. And we're encouraging other communities to organize, run it up the flagpole and see if it works. We're in this together as a nation. We grew up November the 4th, 2008. That's got to mean something. Just forget about Barack Obama. Just what we did, we the people.
Sonny Scroggins, a political activist from Topeka, Kansas, who wants to create a national, he was calling it an Obama Day, and maybe he'd be open to changing the name of it, but someday to commemorate what just happened in our national election. Have I got that right, Sonny?
You're absolutely right. I'm just struggling with joy, Robin.
Well, thanks for speaking to us about it.
Thanks, Robin.
And by the way, some of the stories we're working on at Here and Now includes a look at white supremacist groups in the U.S. in the wake of the election of Barack Obama. We'll have that for you in the coming days. Also ask, what's next for the Republican Party? We'll ask that of conservative humorist P.J. O'Rourke, who is angry. He says conservatives blew the last election. That's in the coming days. Back in a minute with Wally Here and Now. Welcome back to Here and Now. In the highly acclaimed hit film WALL-E from Disney Pixar, the title character is a trash-compacting robot who's left alone on Earth when humans abandon the garbage-covered planet. As WALL-E faithfully roams through the rubbish, he collects things that catch his eye and dreams of a life with some companionship besides his pet cockroach. Then one day, a spaceship lands. Out emerges Eve, a much more advanced robot, who immediately begins flying around on a reconnaissance mission. WALL-E is instantly smitten, and his love for Eve will lead him to a spaceship containing the last remaining humans, a world he never knew existed. WALL-E is the brainchild of director and co-writer Andrew Stanton, who also directed and co-wrote the Oscar-winning film Finding Nemo. WALL-E comes out on DVD today. Here Now's Emiko Tamagawa spoke with Andrew Stanton when the film first came out, and she asked, where did he get this idea?
We had a lunch where we were trying to come up with what will we do after Toy Story, and we came up with A Bug's Life. But to get there, we had thrown out a bunch of other little half-baked ideas, and one of them was the idea of the sci-fi context of what if everybody left the planet and there was just this robot that didn't know it could stop doing what it's doing, and it did it forever. And I thought that was the saddest idea ever. And so you have to jump to 2002, and I'm in the middle of writing or rewriting on Nemo, and I suddenly thought about this little guy again, and I just wanted to explore it more. And by the time Nemo came out and was so successful, it really kind of gave me the confidence to try something this sort of outside of the box, because I figured that, one, the technology had advanced enough to probably realize what I was thinking we should do. We had become better filmmakers over all that time with all the other films, and I think there was enough trust from the audience with Pixar that they might come to see something that's a little different.
One of the things that, in a way, they're very different is Nemo is a very verbal film. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of back and forth. There's a lot of humor. The first 15, 20 minutes of WALL-E is sound and music without dialogue. Did you think that was going to be hard for audiences? Or
I completely have faith in the audience and know that they're smarter than anybody ever gives them credit for. It's just whether people would have the patience for me to figure out how to do it correctly and how to do it well enough that people would be completely engaged. Because I know when it's done well, because there's been plenty of moments like this in the history of cinema. It's just if you don't do it right, then it's annoying. And if you do it right, then people don't really even realize that they're being denied some element.
The thing about WALL-E is he's got a very particular look. He's part tape player. Mm-hmm. He's very mechanical. Mm-hmm. And yet he's incredibly expressive.
Yeah. A lot of that came from finding the right design. The big epiphany was getting some binoculars handed to me at a baseball game. And I turned them around and I started making them sad and then mad and then happy and stern. And I realized the power of that. There was a whole character right there. And that was the big sort of opening. And then once we came up with all the other elements of making him a roving trash compactor, making him sort of collapse like a turtle, that gave him a very shy quality, then you just put it in the hands of really great animators. And those guys are just such a master of how to do a lot with a little. Just tiny movements can suddenly mean so much.
WALL-E breaks your heart because he's wandering alone on this planet. And the only thing that he has that sort of gives him any pleasure is, you know, Hello, Dolly on the TV.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know. Isn't that odd? Why? I know I'm going to get asked that question for the rest of my life. Well, it didn't come right away. It was sort of a Reese's Peanut Butter Cup moment where my chocolate fell into the peanut butter. You know, I was just sort of playing this music of the song Put On Your Sunday Clothes when I was looking for sort of old songs. I was trying all these things because I knew I wanted something old-fashioned to listen to while you're looking at the future of space. And I loved that juxtaposition. And when that phrase out there got said at the head of the song, it just worked. And then the more I thought about it, I thought, you know, this song is about two naive guys that have never left their small little world and they want to go out and sort of experience life and all they really want to do is kiss a girl. And I thought, that's Wally.
Out there, full of shine and full of sparkle, close your eyes and see it glisten, Barnaby.
And then I looked into other songs that were from that. Because I thought, what if he watched that movie? That was one of the things he found in the trash. And there was It Only Takes a Moment, and it showed these two people holding hands. And I realized that is the strongest way a character that can't say, I love you, show that they do. And that helped me so much in opening up the story and how to tell the story that I never looked back. For as odd of an idea as it is, I think it works really well.
And of course, into this solitude comes this robot that does lasers and zips around. I thought she was out of Wally's league.
Well, she probably is. You know, I think he had to earn his place, you know, which most men do.
Wally!
This is a great movie for kids. You know, it's fun. There is, shall we say, a less than flattering picture of what humanity could be.
Yeah. Well, the biggest thing I needed was some sort of something out of whack with humanity for Wally to have an effect on. And I thought the biggest thing I loved about Wally that I thought was so poetic was that he was a machine, yet he seemed to have more life than anything else. So I thought, what if humanity had lost the point of living? And so the biggest thing I was inspired by was distraction. Just it's already feeling like it's happening now, that there's a million things to keep you from really directly contacting or talking to the person next to you. You know, you can have your cell phone, your iPod, you name it, whatever your poison. And you can have a million things going on to keep you preoccupied, but you're not really living. And I thought, well, what if technology got so advanced that all the real issues of life, your health, how long you live, and food, and all that stuff got solved, and you'd have nothing to do but distract yourself. And so that just made logical sense to me. And then the other fact that pushed me in that direction was when I found out that in research that NASA does for long-term residency in space, they have to really still solve the gravity issue, because if they don't get it just right, disuse atrophy kicks in and you would lose your bones slowly if you were out in space for too long. And sort of osteoporosis kicks in and you would eventually become a big blob of jello if you were out there too long. And so I thought that was a perfect way to portray people that had nothing to do. I didn't want it to be off-putting. I didn't want anybody to be slobs or unsightly. So I thought, well, what if nature sort of evolved you into sort of a baby, just big babies?
That's the thing, because they, you know, they are sort of blobby, but they're all very good-natured.
Right. I wanted you to sympathize with humanity. I don't want you to dislike humanity. I want you to root for everybody having things improve.
The picture of it looks like the Earth in 700 years.
Yeah.
It's got this very bleak quality to it. It's very dark.
I don't think it's that dark. My gosh. I mean, we listen to fairy tales about wolves eating people. I didn't see anything that dark about it. I just knew that it's a science fiction, it's about the future, and it's about the last robot on Earth. So I have to come up with some reason why everybody's gone, and it's not going to be a good reason that everybody leaves. So I knew that, you know, he was going to be this little wonderful light in the middle of all the sort of gray. And that would make people feel fine and that it was all going to be okay in the end. So I'm not too worried. I go to see a story to see why something will get improved or a problem will get solved or why something will change. I don't go to watch The Happy Village with happy people in it.
That's WALL-E director and co-writer Andrew Stanton speaking to Here and Now's Emiko Tamagawa. WALL-E comes out on video today. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again. Here and Now.
Did you think that your feet had been bound by what gravity brings to the ground? Did you feel you were tricked by the future you picked? Well, come on down. All these rules don't apply when you're